The following podcast may contain mature themes and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the No Fear Friday edition of the No Fear Project podcast. I'm your host, Pete D'Amico. I put out the call to talk to those of you on the front line of the COVID-19 fight, or teachers, or essential workers, or really any of you that want to share your thoughts, fears, stories, strategies during this lockdown. A few people reached out, and I hope a few more do in the coming weeks. Today, we have a great talk with Lauren Perello. Lauren is from suburban Chicago and has a unique view of the quarantine. I can't wait for you to hear what Lauren has to share right after these words from our sponsor, Silver Fox Athletics. If you are anything like me, you have big goals. I really wanted to become a better runner, and you guessed it, fear was stopping me. I needed a running coach. Enter Coach Andy and Silver Fox Athletics. I started working with Coach Andy, and he produced the perfect customized training plan. His plan and support were just what I needed. The fear started melting away instantly. I ended up with a shiny new personal record in the half marathon and even conquered my biggest running fear of all, the 26.2-mile marathon. Coach Andy specializes in those middle and back-of-the-pack runners like me, and even those that have never run much. Get more information about Silver Fox Athletics at silverfoxathletics.org. Also, follow Silver Fox Athletics on Instagram. While you are there, click book to get your free initial consultation with Coach Andy. Make sure to tell him you heard about Silver Fox on the No Fear Project. We are now joined by Lauren Perello. Lauren, thank you for joining us here on the No Fear Project.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
Absolutely. Thank you. So why don't you just give everybody a quick rundown of kind of who you are, what you do, and what makes Lauren tick?
How much time we got?
Yeah, as much as you want.
So my name is Lauren Perello. I am a teacher. I live right now in Downers Grove. I've been teaching for 13 years now. So lucky 13 with all that's going on. But I teach fifth grade and I absolutely love it. I've been, you know, lucky enough to fall into my passion with teaching. It's just something that, you know, I'm very passionate about, and it's not just a career for me. It's a hobby. It's just kind of what I do. I love it. So there's that. Outside of that, I am fairly active. I am a runner, triathlete, I've competed in 14 Ironman distance triathlons. So it's kept me busy. And then about 3 years ago, things kind of took a little turn and I wasn't feeling so hot. I got diagnosed after lots of testing and all that stuff. I got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which kind of changed everything. I haven't done an Ironman since. I've done other fitness pursuits. I coach now and all that, but it's given me a different perspective on things. And to this day, I could actually almost say I'm thankful for it because of the brand new perspective that it's given me. So yeah, I mean, I deal with that on a daily basis. I'm fairly active and I teach. I think that's about it.
that's a lot right there. Plenty, yeah. Actually, probably. So before we launch into the teaching stuff, help us understand, what do you mean by the different perspective that has given you and how you're thankful for it?
Sure. So you know, beforehand, I don't want to say that I took everything for granted, but I don't think, at least my new perspective is kind of shown me that I don't think people take enough time to really step back and reflect on what we do have in this life. And without sounding like too, I don't know, preachy or whatnot, it's, and I'm not, you know, I was brought up Italian Catholic, and I'm not practicing now. But I just feel like this diagnosis has made me forced me to take a step back. And then in that step back, I've really been able to reflect on, you know, what am I in control of? What do I have control of? And if it's something that's outside of my control, I only have a limited amount of energy to spend every day. And the MS has given me that, but you know, everybody is given X amount of energy to spend. And I have to ask myself, is this really worth, you know, spending my energy on? And if it's not, you know, I think it saved me from being in a lot of situations over the last couple of years, that I normally would have spent too much energy on. And therefore, with my new diagnosis, making myself sick, because of it. So it's just really taught me to appreciate what I have, especially once something was, you know, taken away. And I'm just thankful for so many of the little things, I guess, that I never really took the time to care about in the past.
That's fantastic. I mean, I think we all strive for that perspective, and sometimes big life changes are needed in order to gain it. I wish that there was ways that we can continue to find that in between those times. Cause I know for myself, even right now with the pandemic and being quarantined, it's really changed my perspective on a lot of things too. And it has me thinking about how you viewed fear before and after your diagnosis. Was there a change? Like, did you have any big fears before, or did the diagnosis with MS change how you viewed fear in general?
I think it definitely changed how I viewed fear in general. The fears that I've had in the past, I don't dwell, I guess, on those anymore. So it goes back to that taking a step back and really taking the time to reflect, you know, gain that big picture perspective. And I've had fears. Am I going to be able to, cause I'm single. I live alone. I'm in my 30s, not exactly ideal, but I had this fear of, am I going to be able to take care of myself for, you know, now that I've got this diagnosis, am I going to be okay? And it's taught me that I'm so much stronger than I've given myself credit for in the past. So it was a big fear of mine. And now I've learned that, wow, yeah, I can do that. And another fear that I've had in the past is letting people in to my life. Asking for help is something I'm really bad at. And I think that's just the way I was raised, for one. You know, everybody kind of did their own thing, took care of themselves. And this has shown me the diagnosis, this pandemic, this has shown me that, you know, I have to be okay with asking for help sometimes, because people want to give it. It's out there. And so it's given me a different perspective on that too. So I think the diagnosis, it changed everything. When I say everything, I know it's just so broad, but that fear piece, it just teaches, it's taught me so much more about myself. And are those fears really something rational? Are they something I can control or something I cannot control?
That's huge. When you were going through the long testing process, were you more fearful about what the diagnosis was going to be, or that they wouldn't figure out what was wrong? I haven't gotten asked these types of questions, so forgive me if they're not kind of on point, but I find it fascinating how people handle these things. And I think it can help a lot of people that listen to know what others are going through. So is there anything you could share with us about that process in between?
Sure. You know, it's a really good question, because I feel like that time period does get overlooked. It's like you go from not feeling so great to bam, you have a diagnosis. But those months, and for some people it's years, but I was lucky enough that it was a matter of about 6 months from when I first started feeling like there was something wrong. And upon reflection now, like years later, I can see that there were some warning signals over like the years prior to when I really started feeling sick, that I can say, oh, I wonder if that was, you know, that should have been a clue, or that should have been an indication that something was wrong. But, you know, everybody has, especially as an athlete too, I have aches and pains all the time. It's, you know, I would chalk it up to, oh, I'm just sore. Or, oh, maybe I slept on my arm wrong and that's why my hand's all tingly, or something like that. So when I first started getting really sick, I was actually training at a pretty high level for the year prior to that. I had done 3 Ironman triathlons. I had PR'd every race. I was getting my personal best times. And then I was like, you know what? I am really going to commit to this. I am going to throw my life into it. I was going to go for a Kona slot for Ironman Hawaii. So I moved up to Madison for 2 months. Like, it was a little crazy, but I was throwing my life into my training. And my doctors now say that that was actually a good thing, because I was very in tune with my body. Like, I could tell when something was not right. Because I was, you know, fueling and exercising and sleeping, and just, I was really tracking everything. So I went into the emergency room a few times thinking that I had like a heat exhaustion, heat stroke episode, from exercising too much. And they chalked it up to that originally, saying that, you know, it was too much time, you're dehydrated. They would give me some fluids and send me home. And it's like, no, I know there's still something wrong. And, you know, I went to a general practitioner, and then I was sent to so many different doctors. You know, a neurologist was one of the last I was sent to, but they thought I could have had lupus. They thought I could have had cancer. They thought I could, they're throwing out all of these big, you know, scary, hairy words, I was calling them, to where I was like, are we ever going to, like you mentioned, figure out what's wrong? Or am I just going to be living like this forever? Like, I don't feel good, and I know there's something wrong. So then, you know, there were MRIs and CTs, and finally a spinal tap test in December of 2016 was what they used to conclude and give me my diagnosis. So December 13th, 2016, never forget it, was the day that they told me about it. And when I was told, like, I already had that in my head that it could be a possibility, especially once I was sent for the spinal tap. But I don't want to, it wasn't like a big slap in the face, because I knew it was a possibility. It was almost like a, okay, like, exhale. That's what it is. All right, we have an answer now. So now we can start working towards, you know, managing, because I know this isn't a disease that there's a cure for, but we can manage now. We know what's wrong. And so it was almost, of course, I went through all the stages of grief, denial, anger. Don't get me wrong. There were lots of bad moments, but, you know, hearing what it actually was, it was almost helpful, because then we could work on a plan towards me living a lifestyle that I wanted to live.
That makes a lot of sense to me, and I appreciate you sharing it, because that is the part that gets lost, and we just don't talk about it all that often. So that's huge. So where are you at now, like, in terms, you mentioned coaching. Are you able to do any running or anything?
Yeah, so I am coaching, which is great, and I've invested in a decent-sized gym that I continue to invest in, because one of my biggest triggers for my MS symptoms is heat and humidity. So if I start getting warm, or if it's humid out, I get what I call like the brain fog. I get this cognitive fog. And so I need to keep my body temperature low. So because of that, I have a treadmill, my bike set up to a trainer, weights inside, and my windows are open almost all winter, and I keep the air conditioning on, you know, pretty cold in the summer. So I can do plenty. Last year, my goal was to run 2019 miles in 2019, and I did it. 98% of it was on a treadmill.
Wow.
But it was because I could have a fan above me, I could manage the air temperature in the house. I was able to keep the air conditioning on if I needed to, or the windows open if, you know, it got warm in here. And I was able to manage to where I almost get nervous running outside now if it's not, you know, a 30 degree day. Cause even if it's 50, which is used to be prime running weather in my mind, 40s to 50s, even if there's a little bit of humidity in the air, that could get to my head and make me not feel well.
That's pretty interesting. I've not handled humidity well myself in the past, but nothing like that. So that, again, helps give perspective on what other people are dealing with and how it shapes how our own mind works in there. All this increase in virtual racing, have you taken advantage of any of that?
No, I really haven't. I've done just kind of been doing my own. I feel like with the whole, and then the switch to online teaching and all that, like things have been, it's almost been a new curveball, a new challenge that I've had to deal with, because I've realized I am not good with a lot of screen time, and I'm forced to have a lot of screen time right now with my job. So it's, my running has suffered a bit because I've been getting almost dizzy from staring at the computer screens too much. And I've heard that even people that don't have, you know, cognitive issues, that, you know, you'll have the same problems from staring at a computer screen so much. But no, you know, I kind of do it because it makes me feel good still. I'm still undecided with if I'm shooting for a specific goal or not. I downloaded the Run 2020 and 2020 app in January, but I am nowhere near ready. So I don't think that that's actually going to be a thing this year. But no virtual stuff, just kind of for me, you know, feel, to stay in shape. And it does, you know, it makes me feel good when I can still get those workouts in.
Absolutely. Well, it takes a certain mental strength to spend all that time on a treadmill. I'm not a treadmill runner, so I admire the fact that you found a way to adapt to keep your passion going. Obviously, you've got a real passion for fitness, so that's awesome. Pivoting a little bit, you talked about teaching. So help walk us through, what does a typical day look like now for a fifth grade teacher here in Illinois?
It's so different. And I don't know if you have the Chicago Tribune or not, but there was an article that was put out about virtual online teaching on Monday. And my district was actually highlighted in it because we were fairly well prepared for this. We had done a pilot e-learning day last year, actually, to make up for one of the cold days that we had. And it was a success. So my staff was pretty prepared. I mean, I don't think anybody could be prepared for something like this, but we at least knew our way around, you know, different ideas and structures and strategies we wanted to put in place with our kids. But I mean, now I still set my alarm. I get up and like take a shower like I'm going to work. And then I just basically move about, you know, 10 feet to my couch and open up the computer. And it's every day I will assign certain assignments for my kiddos. And then there's a variety, I should say, of different resources they have where they could contact me and I could contact them directly. We use a program called Go Guardian, which I can set up a session on it and actually see all of the kids' computer screens, what they're doing. So then if they're struggling with something and they're on it, they can open up the chat feature and say, you know, Miss Perello, I'm on this question, you know, and they'll ask me what their question is. If they don't understand something, I could zoom in on their computer screen and see exactly where they're at, what they're struggling with. And then I can type right back to them. Or we've also been using the Zoom platform for, I use it for like full class meetings, just for kind of some fun stuff. We'll all get together just to see each other and laugh. And I did a little scavenger hunt this week with them. They're all running around their house finding things for the scavenger hunt. But I'll also use it for some small group actual learning too, where the kids will, I'll have a Zoom meeting for four or five kids. And I'll say, okay, at, you know, 5 o'clock, or not 5 o'clock, at 10 o'clock, I'll have, you know, you five sign into this group, and we're going to talk about this section of this book. And they'll all sign on, and we'll talk about the book. And so that way I can get as close to a guided reading session as I can virtually in with them. But it's just a lot of creativity with what and learning from and stealing from other teachers. You know, we're all helping one another out. You know, did that work for you? Oh, it didn't. Okay. Well, this worked for me, and sharing ideas. And then once a week, my whole team comes together via Zoom and we talk about the week. We talk about maybe some kids that are struggling, what we can do for them as a team. And if we could reach out to other support staff that can reach out to these kids too, to help them along, because every kid, you know, we don't know what's going on in every kid's house right now. We have families that, you know, both of their parents were furloughed. They don't have jobs. We have some kids that their parents are still going to work every day and they're by themselves at home. So to expect a 10-year-old to do hours of work on their own is just, it's really not feasible. And, in such a scary and unpredictable time, in my mind, you know, I tell my kids in the beginning of every school year, my number one job here is to keep you safe. And I'm still doing that, even though I'm not in the same room with you. So whether that safety is physical safety, their health, but I think emotional health is a big piece to this that we really as a whole society and teachers especially need to focus on with our kids, because it's scary and they're little. So they need help in that department.
Have you found yourself having to pivot to being more of a confidant for some of the kids to that end, or are there school psychologists available? How are you working through that?
So there are, we do have our support staff available and they're reaching out to, you know, our real high risk kids. But in a situation like this, you know, that you really can't prepare for, if you're in a building that has one psychologist and we have 500 kids in the building, you know, all of our kids are experiencing this, from, you know, their own perspective. And, we've had lots of kids that need additional support. So I began by, you could see the kids that weren't either participating in a Zoom meeting or they weren't getting their work done. I was reaching out to them, asking them, you know, oh, you know, is everything okay? Were you able to access, you know, this resource or that resource? And for me, I wasn't worried about, oh, how come you didn't get this work done or the quality of the work. I was worried about the kid and, you know, is there something going on that I can help you with? So then when I would see them, their screen pop up on Go Guardian or whatever resource we were using, I could actually talk to the kid and say, okay, you know, were you able to get this done? All right. So how is everything else going? So I'd start with school to like connect that way and then try to create an open dialogue for them so they understand that I am here if they have anything they want to talk about, school related or not. And some of the kids have opened up. Some days I'll open up the computer, open up Go Guardian, and as soon as that little chat feature opens up on their computers, they all start messaging me at the same time. I mean, I have some that'll tell me it'll be 11:30 and she'll say, I had a girl yesterday, well, Miss Prowl, I have to go eat lunch. I'll be right back. And I was like, oh, it's, you know, you don't have to tell me. It's okay. You know, just take your lunch break. And at 11:38, 8 minutes later, okay, Miss Prello, I'm back. Good. You know, I wasn't worried, but I'm glad you're back. But then, there are still those kiddos that aren't responding. So we're trying to reach out this way. We're trying to call homes, to see what we can do. But, you know, everyone's dealing with this differently and everybody has different situations. So there is a big counseling piece to this. In addition to the academics, of course.
Is that something that, I mean, I don't know like how you guys are prepared or with ongoing education. Are you guys given training on that kind of support, or is that just natural teacher instincts kicking in?
You know, it's natural teacher instincts. I'd have to say we don't really have, you know, a lot of, it is unfortunate. And I wonder if that will change in the future, but, our professional development sessions we have are very, you know, academic based. They're not that social emotional piece. My district actually has, we do a social emotional lesson every week with our classes and we do a lot of cooperative structures. So that it's something that we're all, you know, aware of, but, you know, part of being a teacher that I think a lot of, a lot of people miss is that, you know, we're not just there to teach academics. There are some days that, you know, I spend more time being a psychologist or a counselor or social worker, with a group of kids or one kid than I do actually teaching academics, because you wear so many hats as a teacher throughout the day. And unfortunately, we are trying to wear all those hats from our own homes for these kids. And it's just, you know, the barrier of not actually being there in front of them. It's challenging, and it's really hard. When they announced last week that school was going to be closed, for the rest of the year, I had girls, like their parents, and then a girl was on the phone with me crying that she wanted to go back. And that's, I wanted to say that I was holding back tears too, because I love my job and being able to see those kids every day. And so this is just a very, very challenging time. And so we have had to change really our expectations too, and realize that social emotional, that psychology piece is probably far more important at this time than, you know, did we miss a few standards, teaching a few standards this year?
Yeah, that's totally understandable. And as we look at the bigger picture with this pandemic and lessons that we'll learn, I have to wonder if that's not going to help it, maybe, how do I want to put it, like enhance the training that teachers get and within their education and then ongoing, and just resources that are available to you, because this had to highlight, I can't imagine going through this, honestly, what you guys are, because in person, just with our own children, it's difficult to navigate through this. To be in even a virtual environment with them has to make it tougher, because I think if it was within the classroom, at least you can see more of the nonverbal cues and all that. So I really admire what you and all teachers are doing at this point, with this kind of new normal or temporary new normal. And I'm wondering, have they talked to you at all about what a new normal returning to classrooms may look like? Are they speculating on how that might work yet?
No, I've heard so many different ideas, basically being, they're all ideas now just being thrown up in the air, what that could look like, whether it be, you know, having kids sit separately or less students in a classroom, which would honestly be really nice. But I don't know. And I feel like there are so many unanswered questions that it's scary for me, because I can't imagine not going back to in-person learning in August. But there are so many steps that I know we would have to take. And I look at this from the bringing it back to like my MS perspective on this, for kids or teachers, adults, anybody working in the buildings that are immunocompromised, this is still going to be a big concern come August, come September. So there are a lot of pieces that are going to have to be in place before we can really safely jump back into whatever our new normal is going to look like. But right now, honestly, we are doing this day by day, and it's teachers. I'll tell you, if someone was asking me, well, you know, now that you're at home, are you, you know, do you think you're working less? And I laugh, because I'm genuinely working. It's like last night, I think the last, paper that I responded to a kid was about 10:40 last night. And then, you know, I was on by 7:30 this morning. So I feel like I took breaks during the day and got a quick run in and all that. But I am definitely putting far more time in now, and I know all of my colleagues are, than we do. Because it's just not feasible when you're working with, you're trying to, let's say, teach a group of five kids a skill or talk about one thing. Instead of, if some of them don't sign on to a Zoom conference, you know, instead of pulling them all to a table like we would in the classroom, I need to reach out to each one of those kids individually. And so it's 5 minutes here, 5 minutes here, 5 minutes. So it just adds up. So it's a lot of time being spent, you know, you could do in like a smaller group setting when you're actually in the classroom. So it's, It'll be, I mean, I can't even wrap my head around what it may look like in August and September. And I don't think administrators have any idea at this point, because we are genuinely working on, you know, one day at a time right now and getting our kids to, through this school year, because my biggest fear was that after that announcement, my kids were going to kind of check out saying, okay, well, school's over. And I made sure right away to post a video of myself saying, no, you know, in-person class is over, but school, like your fifth grade school year isn't over until June. You know, I'm like, you're stuck with me guys another 6 weeks. Like we are still going to be learning and doing activities and so forth. It's just going to look different. So for as far as the fall, your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I can't get my head around it either, which is one of the reasons I wanted to ask the question. So I don't feel so bad, because if you guys can't, when you understand the dynamics of what has to happen just from a classroom perspective much better than we do, then I don't feel so left behind on that. So a couple of questions for us parents. First, is there anything that parents can do that would help their kids get to class, get to those Zoom classes, get to Google Classroom and all these other tools that people are using? Any advice for us from that perspective?
Outside of the, like the tech piece, as long as you know how to, you know, get to each of those platforms, I really, what I've been telling many parents, I've had Zoom, my first Zoom parent-teacher conferences, which never thought I'd be doing. But, you know, what I've been telling parents is to give themselves, their kids, their families grace to really understand that this, your school day, you know, quote unquote school day at home does not need to look like the 8-to-3 school day that the kids would normally be participating in at, you know, at in-person school. So setting those timers of those expectations for, let's say, okay, we have your teacher's holding a 10 a.m. Zoom meeting today. We have that on the schedule. We'll set an alarm for that. We're also going to be doing this, and we'll do this at this time. But I think expecting, you know, our little ones that, you know, from preschool, you've got your 4, 5, 6-year-olds up to elementary, middle, and high school, to expect them to sit down for a 6-7 hour period is just unreasonable. So really chunking things up and giving kids freedom to do other things that aren't academically related in between those, okay, this 10 a.m. Zoom meeting or this 12 p.m. read aloud that the teacher is going to do, allowing the kids to just have a choice. Okay, you want to go play your game? You want to go play outside? I've never been a big advocate for video games. You can ask any of my students. I sit and I talk about how they're playing far too many of them. But now, right now, what else are you going to do? So if, you know, they want to play their video games, things like that, like this is a different time. So I really would just advise parents to look at what those have to's are, I've been calling them. Set your alarms for those so the kids understand in the morning, you know, this is what we're doing at this time. This is what we're doing at this time. And then giving them grace to just be kids and play during those times in between, I think are so important, and really reset the kids, reboot the kids for whatever the next scheduled activity would be later on in the day.
That's awesome. Great advice, because I think a lot of us parents are beating ourselves up for not being able to get the kids to do everything you want. I happen to have two older ones that I don't have to worry about. They're doing a good job, but the little one, the preschool one, has been a challenge. So it took me a while to kind of settle down, realize that she's not going to be all that far behind. You guys are great teachers and you'll catch her up as soon as we can get back at it. But not being able to go to a building every day for her was such a big difference. And she'll just say to me, Daddy, this isn't school. This is home. So, you know, they know the difference. So it's been a tough struggle on all that. You mentioned immunocompromised. Is having MS considered to be immunocompromised?
Yes. So So I am immunocompromised. I have, so for MS, there are a variety of different, ways you can kind of attack how you're going to manage your illness. And I'm on a DMT, a disease modifying therapy that is, and it, I get it through an infusion 2 times a year. And it's an awesome day that I get to go to an infusion center, sit there for a good 8 hours and just, like fill up my tank, I guess you could say. But when I do get that infusion, mine is called Ocrevus. What it does is it targets the cells in my immune system. And it destroys them. So my nerve cells will stop attacking my body. So I, because it does that, it almost has like a chemo effect, with my immune system. So after getting that, I normally pre-pandemic, I would stay home from school for a day or two afterwards because let's face it, working in a building with 500 little, you know, germy bodies is not the best environment when my body is recovering from getting this infusion. But for now, my next infusion, my neurologist has recommended me stay home for a period to stay quarantined for a period of about 3 weeks. Which again, especially I heard that the governor may be extending it till the end of May today or something. It won't exactly be a problem. But I will have to, you know, stay home and just take care of myself. You know, if I do have to go outside, like last week, I had to go to the pharmacy to pick up a prescription. I wore my gloves. I had my mask on. I went through the drive-thru and I even brought a bottle of Lysol and I sprayed the prescription when they gave it to me. I must have looked nuts, but in my mind, I was like, you know what? It is better to be safe than sorry. So just, I got to take precautions. And I think that it's really something we all should just kind of be living with that mindset of, okay, we could be getting sick. Let's do what we can. And then continue moving on because we can't just sit and be scared of this because, you know, it's out there. It's a reality right now. And so moving into the next school year, I'm not going to honestly do anything differently than I normally do. I live immunocompromised. So my hands are always cracking because they're dry from washing them all the time and the amount of hand sanitizer I use. But just staying up with that is, I think, what we, you know, we all should be doing, just to make sure we're keeping ourselves healthy and safe.
Absolutely. I keep saying that I really hope we are all washing our hands a lot before this was happening. So if you weren't, thanks for catching up. We appreciate right. it all. So I'm curious, how did the process that you had to go through with being diagnosed, did it have any impact, do you think, on how you viewed this pandemic and the quarantine? Do you think that the one impacted the other?
So as far as how, like, we've all been handling it?
Well, specifically you.
Like, the higher-ups, the government has been handling it?
No, more how you handled it. I mean, I'm sure we all have opinions on how everybody else has, but...
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking more... More along the lines of like kind of how you handle it, your mindset, if you thought it would is different than what it would have been without a diagnosis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to say that this was probably easier for me to fall into than a lot of other people because I already lived the quarantine life. You know, I have to live it twice a year when I get my infusions or if I'm, you know, like sometimes I call it symptomy. I'll start to feel some of my symptoms come up and I know I just need to stand down and stay home for a couple days. So that's just what I have to do. And it's become my new normal. So hearing that we were going to have to do this, it was just for me, it was like, all right, it's unfortunately, like, I mean, I wasn't happy about it. I'm definitely a people person and I just missed, there weren't a lot of places I liked to go, but there were a few, you know, that I missed going out to. And, but it was, for me, it was, I guess it was easier to slide into. Now, of course I'm frustrated. I miss the way it was. I miss being able to go out. I miss my job more than anything. But I would have to say it's probably easier for someone like me, just because I've lived this.
Fantastic. Well, I think that we talked about a lot. Is there anything that I haven't asked about that you wanted to share?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I love the idea for your podcast and the whole fear, the way that you look at it. And I think perspective is everything. So, if I were to, you know, to say anything or to, you know, to talk about anything, taking a look at this pandemic and this quarantine, what we're all going through right now, is for people to really just take a moment to take that step back and reflect and think about what you do have. So for me, even though teaching has been quite a challenge since we've started this online learning, this e-learning, I am still thankful that, you know, I have a job and I am getting paid. And there are a lot of people that my father lost, had to close down his business because of this. And so I have to look at, you know, there are a lot of people going through a lot of things right now. And so trying to look at the things you can control and the being positive about what you still have is just, it's crucial during a period of time like this.
That's great advice. Well, I really appreciate you joining us, and I look forward to getting feedback because I'm sure people are going to love hearing from you.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I cannot thank Lauren enough for joining us. Her story is inspiring, insightful, and full of wisdom. We can use some of her strategies to cope with life, especially in the time of quarantine. I look forward to hearing from more of you. As we wrap up this episode, I want to thank our Patreon supporters, especially our producers, the Endurance for Everyone podcast, Dave Sylvia, and the Money, Motivation, and Motherhood podcast. The support of all our patrons during this trying time is humbling. Please be sure to subscribe to the No Fear Project on your favorite podcast app and consider leaving a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really does help people find the show. And now, more than ever, the way forward is together. The time to conquer is now.
Thank you for listening to the No Fear Project. Original music is from Josh and Dean. Join us on social media by searching the No Fear Project on Facebook and Instagram. Check out thenofearproject.com for more information, including in-person presentations on fear customized for your organization. The No Fear Project is committed to helping those with mental illness get help and to defeating the stigma. If you have any thoughts of harming yourself or suicide, please contact the Suicide Prevention Hotline for help now at 800-273-8255. Remember, you are not alone. The No Fear Project is a production of Paragon Media, all rights reserved.